a mother of four with a connection to Minutemen, disappears in the middle of the night. Are two men who disappeared around the same time connected? A woman who had everything going for her goes missing on a Sunday on her way to her friend's house. Three teenage boys disappear almost 2 years apart from each other. Is it connected? A singer with possible connections to the mafia goes missing. The real question is, who's to blame? Welcome back to Never To Be Seen Again. Hey everyone, welcome back. Y'all, we are at episode 25, which means we are halfway through the States. For this momentous episode, we're going to talk about disappearances in Iowa. We certainly have some super interesting cases for this week, but before we get into the cases, let's talk about Iowa itself. As of 2019, the population of Iowa is reported as 3.15 million. That number is made up of 50.2% female and 49.8% male. The Charlie Project has 89 missing cases listed, with 55 of those being male and 34 of those being female. NamUs has 97 listed cases, with 64 male and 33 female. And the Doe Network has 52 cases of 31 males and 21 females. Once again, we see more missing men than women, and that is true for the cases I'll be covering this week. I have 5 male cases this week and only 3 females. Normally, I like to have it even out, but when we get into these cases, you'll understand why I have to tell you about so many male cases over female cases. But let's not waste any more time, and let's start talking about these disappearances. Okay, we're really going to warm it up with this case. What I'm going to tell you in this case is not made up, although it may sound like it is. All of these cases this week are on all 3 sites, plus a shout out to Iowa, who really makes the effort because they have a cold case site, and all of these cases today are on that site. The write-up on each case is pretty extensive as well, and it actually got a lot of information straight from the site. If you want to check it out, it's iowacoldcases.org, and they have unsolved homicides on that site as well as solve cold cases and missing people. This is case number 1806 DFIA in the Doe Network and case number MP18982 in NamUs. Here we go with the disappearance of Alice Mae Van Alston. Alice is a Caucasian female with brown hair and blue eyes. She was born on July 23rd of 1947. She was 28 at the time of her disappearance, and she would be 72 now. She stood at 5'7" and 128 pounds. Alice's maiden name is Barnes. Alice graduated from Albia High School in Albia, Iowa in 1965. She graduated at the top of her class, and she was described as highly intelligent, outgoing, very attractive, and creative. She loved animals and owned an array of them as a child, one including a raccoon. Her love of animals led her to enroll at Iowa State University after graduating high school with plans to become a veterinarian. She eventually ended up dropping out of college, though, because she no longer had the money for tuition. On July 15th of 1967, Alice married Lee Harlow Andre in Des Moines, Iowa. Together, Alice and Lee had 4 children, but the marriage only lasted for about 8 years. They divorced on January 3rd of 1975. On the same day of Lee and Alice's divorce, Alice married Merrill Everett Van Alston. The marriage lasted 2 days short of a whole year, and they divorced on January 1st of 1976. On Friday, March 26th of 1976, Alice put her children to bed in their home in the 4300 block of Northeastern 29th Street in Polk County, Iowa. Her four children, ages 3, 4, 6, and 8 at this point. And one of the children was not at the house, though, because he or she, and I'm not sure if it was a boy or girl, was a patient in a state institution. Two of Alice's four children were born handicapped, and a third suffered from epilepsy. So not only do these children need their mother because of their age, but the majority of them suffer from some type of medical problem where Alice would need to be around to take care of them. The following Sunday, Alice's neighbors found her three children alone in the apartment. The neighbors reported her missing that day. Now, there are some discrepancies about the actual last date of contact. Some agencies list it as April 2nd of 1976, and some say it was March 26th of 1976. In most places, it says she was reported missing on April 4th, which would line up correctly if her date of last contact is April 2nd. If she was last seen on March 26th, she would have been reported on March 28th. So, in any case, the difference between dates is only 1 week apart, but we know that she was reported missing the Sunday after she was last seen on the Friday. When law enforcement gets there, they make a few discoveries. Alice's 6-year-old son told the police that when he got up on Saturday morning, mommy wasn't there. They look through the apartment and they find that Alice left her shoes, coat, purse, and money. Now, why is this odd? Well, the temperatures on that Friday night were close to freezing, so if Alice left on her own, she would have grabbed at least her coat and some shoes. When officers started looking around the apartment, they find Alice's car is still in the parking area. And if that didn't throw another odd kink in the chain, the way they find her car makes the situation more suspicious. The car door was open and her keys were in the ignition. Now, there is something else that I found odd that police found in the apartment. There was a broken bottle on the floor of the apartment, and there were also some spent bullet casings. Police say those casings may not have been significant, though. They say Alice was a good sharpshooter who had been on the rifle team when she was in college. Alice and her first husband, Leandre, would practice shooting inside using walls, mattresses, and piles of magazines to catch the bullets. This is crazy to me. If it's true, how do you do this in a house or an apartment and your neighbors don't have a problem with it, and you have kids in the house? Police apparently weren't concerned about this, though, and I'm not sure, but I don't know if they collected any of those casings. So I don't know if police just initially thought that Alice ran off, but what they do is issue a warrant for her arrest after she goes missing for child desertion. Now, by all accounts, Alice was an attentive mother who loved her children and would have never left them in the middle of the night. Now, in Alice's case, we have two pretty good theories about what happened to her, but as always, no real evidence. Let's talk about the first theory and the less believed theory. Leandre, was apparently a very abusive husband. So much so that his and Alice's three children's disabilities were caused by severe beatings Alice had sustained during her pregnancies, allegedly. Around the time of Alice's disappearance, Lee was seeking custody of their children. In fact, he admitted to law enforcement that he had actually stopped by her apartment the day she went missing to discuss the custody issue. Now, I could not find anything about what happened during that discussion or how it went, but that seems at least a little suspicious to me. According to Lee, though, he didn't believe that foul play was involved in Alice's disappearance and that she had just left. Now, let's talk about the second theory and more widely believed theory. Almost all of Alice's friends and family believe that Alice had been kidnapped and killed by Minutemen or Minutemen sympathizers. At the time of Alice's disappearance, she wanted to leave the organization, and the belief is that Alice knew too much about their activities in Iowa and they viewed her as a traitor. Now, do you remember what Minutemen are? If not, I'll remind you. The Minutemen organization was founded by Robert Depew of Missouri in 1959. Minutemen believed that a communist takeover was imminent, and so they were known to stockpile weapons, ammunition, and explosives. They were also known to carry out right-wing paramilitary acts. So Alice's first husband, Lee Andre, was also allegedly a member of the Minutemen. Apparently, Alice and Lee, especially Lee, were pretty involved in the organization in Iowa. And because of this, Alice saw a lot during the course of their marriage. When the marriage to Lee ended, though, Alice wasn't so interested in the organization anymore and started to pull away from it. She pulled away so much, in fact, that she had actually recently begun cooperating with law enforcement. This next piece I'm going to tell you is pretty much directly from the Iowa Cold Case site. On July 21st of 1977, Des Moines Tribune writer Greg Strickachuk and Gene Erb published a page one full-scale exposé on Minutemen activities in Iowa, chronicling several Minutemen-related incidents in the Des Moines area. According to the article, Alice stated in a sworn deposition that while married to Lee Andre, suitcases belonging to Minutemen were left at her home. One of those suitcases contained a Bible with secret coded messages. She also said that the suitcases were burned when Minutemen were sought by authorities. She also claimed that stolen weapons and explosives were stored in her barn. In that same deposition, Alice acknowledged explosives had been used to bomb a Des Moines home and that she'd been visited by FBI agents. The Tribune article also stated that in a 2-hour interview, Lee Andre acknowledged he'd dropped by Alice's apartment the night she disappeared to discuss custody matters with her. Andre also said there wasn't a shred of evidence to suggest foul play in his ex-wife's disappearance. Now, I'll tell you why her family is convinced it had something to do with Minutemen. Apparently, right before Alice disappeared, she spoke to her father, Howard Barnes. During the conversation, she confided in her father and said, "Dad, they, meaning the Minutemen, are going to kill me." Howard Barnes admitted that at the time he really didn't see the Minutemen as a vicious bunch. But when Alice disappeared, he began to connect dots and realized that it was a really strong possibility. But the more he dug, the more he became worried that he would be killed as well, or his home would be bombed. So Howard Barnes, a World War II veteran, began sleeping on the sofa with a loaded 30 caliber carbine near him. And he did that for years. Now, nothing ever happened to Alice's family as a result of the Minutemen stuff, though, at least as far as I could find. I do know that her mother died about 4 years after Alice's disappearance in March of 1980, although I don't know how she died. And Alice's father died 6 years later in October of 1986. As far as I can tell, nothing suspicious there either. There is a bit of an issue when it comes to Alice's case, though. Apparently, in 1993, there was some flooding in that area, and most of the original investigative materials in Alice's case was destroyed. According to the Cold Case site, in July of 2013, the Polk County Sheriff's Office spokesman said that Alice's case remained open, but no detectives were assigned to her case. Now, that was in 2013, so I don't know if anything has changed in the last 7 years. I don't know if all of Alice's four children are still alive, but if they are, they would be 47, 48, 50, and 52, give or take a few months. I don't know, but I assume that they were raised by their father after Alice's disappearance. I'm not even sure if Lee Andre is still alive. What I do know is that Alice is still missing, and foul play is suspected, but her case is unsolved. So, if you would happen to know anything, that could clear this case up finally, please contact the Polk County Sheriff's Office and provide them with any information you have. Okay, so we have five mail cases this week, as I mentioned. Now it is five separate disappearances and different at different times, but some of those cases are believed to be connected. Such is the case with the next two missing men I'm going to tell you about. I have to start by telling you about the disappearance of Stephen Dick Kirk, I'm sorry, Kirchhoff. He is case number 236 DMIA in the Doe Network and case number MP17053 in Namus. Stephen is a Caucasian male with brown hair and brown eyes. He was born on August 16th of 1955 and was 22 at the time of his disappearance. He would be 64 now. He stood at 5'11" and weighed about 140 pounds when he disappeared. He was last seen wearing a short, burnt orange leather jacket, a blue sweater, dark blue corduroy pants, and brown shoes with the word gas, that's spelled GASS, written on the soles. So, what do we know about Stephen's disappearance? Well, I'll tell you this one is going to be a little crazy as well. And it's not crazy because of what we actually know. The rumors and allegations in this case are going to make your head spin. There are some discrepancies in the information I found in this case, but I'll do my best to tell it clearly. On January 23rd of 1978, Stephen spent the night with his girlfriend and the mother of his 2-year-old child. The following day, January 24th, Stephen's brother Tommy saw Stephen between 1 and 5 p.m. at Stephen's house in Cedar Falls. After Tommy didn't see Stephen for about 12 days, Tommy goes to the Waterloo Police Department and reports Stephen missing on February 5th. Stephen was a lineman employed by the Chicago Northwestern Railroad, but just prior to his disappearance, he had been laid off. Now, Stephen had just purchased a house. He was planning on marrying his girlfriend, and he had a child. So, what is Stephen gonna do? Well, allegedly, Stephen had taken to selling drugs. Because of that, it is believed that Stephen was carrying up to about $8,000 when he disappeared. If that was the case, it would have been a good motive for robbery and murder. So, what do police find out? Well, apparently, the police think that Stephen may have gone missing from an apartment on Maxwell Street in Waterloo. This residence was apparently about a mile from his parents' house, and on the day of Stephen's disappearance, a resident in one of the apartments in the complex heard bumping and noises and a man's voice saying, "Oh God, don't do this to me." Now, this may or may not have had anything to do with Stephen's disappearance. To add to this is a good lead. I'm sorry. To add to this as a good lead, shortly after Stephen was last seen, his car was found in a parking lot at the Waterloo Industries Incorporated, which was near Maxwell Street. Now, obviously, Stephen isn't found. Despite his parents hiring private investigators and even consulting psychics. I'm gonna skip ahead a little bit to 2003. In 2003, after Stephen had been missing for about 25 years, police had a tip. The nature of that tip was never released, but we know that the tip was good enough to get a search warrant for a 12-acre farmstead between Fairbank and Denver, Iowa. That piece of property was once owned by a man named Lonson Lonnie Lulliff. He owned this property during the time period that Stephen went missing. Now, Lonnie Lulliff was once described by authorities as one of the largest drug suppliers in the Waterloo area, and he had a crazy story of his own. Lulliff was sentenced to 10 years in prison in 1983 for delivering cocaine to undercover agents. He served about 2 years on that charge before he became a witness in a federal drug case. Now, as you would imagine, turning witness put a price on Lulliff's head. Police were able to intercept two armed hitmen from Minneapolis in 1987. They were on their way to kill Lulliff. They ended up pleading guilty to the murder plot. The scheme was hatched by Lilith's own brother-in-law and involved a police clerical worker who used law enforcement information to get Lilith's address. I guess this didn't scare Lilith off out of the game, though, because in 1994, he was indicted on federal drug, weapon, and money laundering charges. In this case, authorities alleged that the drug ring moved more than 45 kilos of meth between August of 1991 and January of 1993, the value of which being about $649,000. In that case, Lilith took a deal in which she accepted 22 years in prison and 10 years of supervised release in exchange for substantial assistance. Now, Lilith did own this land, but police have never officially named him as a suspect in Stephen's disappearance. I also feel like authorities are insinuating a connection between Lilith's drug dealing and Stephen, who was selling drugs. So, this land. Lilith sold the land sometime around 1988. The owner at the time of the 2003 search, the owners weren't using the land and were actually, in fact, wanting to sell it. The property had a small house and a few outbuildings set back down a dirt road in Bremer County. The property is bordered by a river and public hunting area. During the 2003 search, what I've concluded is ground penetrating equipment was loaned to law enforcement by the FBI. While the search did include all of the property, including the structures, there was a pretty big focus on a particular area in a field. I feel comfortable saying that Stephen wasn't found on that property, but if anything else was found that would help in Stephen's case, I wouldn't know. Law enforcement has never released any of the results of the search, so they may have found some clues, but they're just not releasing that information to the public. The police do announce pretty early in Stephen's investigation that they have a person that they want to speak to that may be connected to Stephen's disappearance. Which leads me to the next missing person, Richard Neal Forsythe. Now, let me tell you about him real quick before we go on. He is case number 82DMIA in the Doe Network and case number MP17087 in Namus. He is a Caucasian male with brown hair and blue eyes. His hair was thinning around the time of his disappearance, so he may be bald now. He was born on August 11th of 1954, and he was 27 at the time of his disappearance. He would be 67 now. He was 6 foot tall and 185 pounds back then. So Richard disappeared right about the same time as Stephen, probably within a week after. From what I read, though, he wasn't actually reported missing until sometime in 1979. So, what's the connection? Well, remember those apartments in Waterloo that Stephen may have last been at? Those apartments were where neighbors heard the bumping sound and the man's voice. Well, those are the apartments that Richard lived at. The day after Stephen was last seen, Richard was seen carrying something wrapped in a rug out of that apartment. Then, the following day, Richard bought a 1972 Cadillac for $2,000. He paid cash for the car in $100 bills. This is relevant because, if you remember, Stephen had that money on him when he disappeared. At the time when he bought the car, apparently Richard's face was bruised and bloody. And when asked about it, he claimed that he had fallen on a wine bottle and had to get stitches. That seems like a hard to believe story to me. So there is what I'm going to call a rumor because if this is true, I have not found anything that substantiates it. It's just something that has been said by people, and I don't know if you could call those people witnesses. The rumor says that Stephen's body, which was in that rug, was carried to the trunk of the Cadillac and driven to the Lolluf's farmstead in Bremer County. According to the rumor, the rug with Stephen's body was then removed from the trunk of the car and brought inside the house. But later, it was returned to the trunk by three people. Once Stephen's body was back in the trunk, they transported the body to a burial site on University Avenue in Waterloo. There was also a rumor that Stephen was killed by a police officer from neighboring agencies, not Waterloo or Cedar Falls, and that the three men were tasked with disposing of his body. Some reports say that Richard left town on the same day he bought the Cadillac. If that is true or not, I'm not sure, but we do know that Richard had those stitches removed in Manhattan, Kansas on February 1st of 1976, I think is the year we're talking about. I'm sorry, it's 1978. I lost what year we were in. So police and Stephen's parents are of course looking for Richard because they want answers and they think that Richard has them. They were able to track Richard to his uncle's house in Arizona shortly after February 1st. But Richard heard about the search for him and he knew that he had been found, so by the time authorities get to Richard's uncle's house, Richard was long gone. Then, over a year later, in mid-1979, the Cadillac that Richard had bought was found in storage in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Apparently, a man by the name of David Gates had left it in storage a year earlier. He only paid 1 month's storage fees. And the same day that the car was put in storage, a man who identified himself as Richard Steves rented a room in Grand Forks, paying for 1 month's rent. The thing is, though, Richard Steves didn't even spend one night in that room. Stephen's parents certainly believe that Richard Steves was Richard Forsythe, but the lady who rented him the room couldn't identify him from a photo. I think it might have been Forsythe as well, and it was really a messed up thing that he used that last name, Steves, as his alias. I think David Gates was probably Forsythe as well, but there is no way to prove any of that. So the Cadillac, well, it wasn't wiped clean. It actually had blood stains. Great, you're saying, right? Wrong. Apparently, the blood stains could not be matched to Stephen's blood. I don't know if this was because of lack of technology or issues with the sample or something like that, but it didn't help further the case at all. Some people, including Stephen's parents, believe that Richard ended up or headed over to Canada. The Canadian border is only about 75 miles from Grand Forks, North Dakota, where the Cadillac was found and the room was rented. Now, I will say that police have never officially said that there was a connection between Stephen and Richard's disappearance, and they have also never said Richard is a suspect in Stephen's disappearance. But anytime you look one of them up, you will inevitably read something about the other. I have no further reported sightings of Richard after this point, at least none that I could find reported. Richard Forsythe is still reported missing, and I feel like there is a good chance that he may still be alive, but some people believe that he too was robbed and murdered. Stephen Kirchhoff is still missing as well. His parents believe that he is dead. They believe this so much, in fact, that they had his name added to their gravestone by 2003. Now, I don't know if his parents are still alive, but when they are buried, their son's name will be listed with theirs on their headstone. If you know anything about the whereabouts of Stephen Dick Kirchhoff or Richard Neal Forsythe, you can contact the Waterloo Police Department to report any and all information about either of them. Okay, let's talk about another female disappearance. This is case number 359DFIA in the Doe Network. And case number MP17144 in Namus. This is the disappearance of Naomi Wilson. Naomi is an African American female with black hair and brown eyes. She was born on August 20th of 1948. She was 32 at the time of her disappearance, and she would be 71 now. She was 5'3" tall and 112 pounds. She was last seen wearing a black two-piece pantsuit. Naomi's ears are pierced, and her maiden name is Pollard. Naomi was raised in Birmingham, Alabama. After high school, she moved to Chicago, where she met and married Benny Wilson. Naomi and Benny moved to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in the late 70s. By 1978, though, Benny and Naomi divorced, and Naomi began dating Colbert Billy Beats, Benny's uncle. In the summer of 1980, Naomi bought a car, bought a house, and bought some furniture for her new house. She was still dating Colbert, and she was making good money at her job. Naomi, by all accounts, is level-headed and reliable. So it's Sunday, April 12th of 1981. Now, usually, Naomi would be at church, but she decided not to go to church this day. Colbert did go to church, though, and he attended the noon service. After church, Colbert had headed over to Naomi's house at 1618 13th Avenue in Southeast Avenue Southeast. I'm sorry. The street names are weird. It's 1618 13th Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. It's about 4 p.m., and Naomi and Colbert leave the house within minutes of each other. Naomi was headed to get gas, and then she was going to go visit a coworker and friend. Colbert was bringing some ice to his mother's house. Colbert said that about an hour after they left Naomi's house, he passed Naomi headed in the opposite direction of her friend's house. The next day, Monday, Naomi was scheduled to work the night shift at her job at, I'm going to get this so wrong, Herrenschwegger Corporation plant. When she didn't show up for work at her scheduled time, they called Colbert. This prompted Colbert to report Naomi missing. At this point in time, Naomi had been with Colbert for 3 years. During that time, Colbert's brothers had become pretty involved in Naomi's life. So when she is reported missing, the brothers take a lead in searches for her. Naomi was one of five children. Two of her brothers had died prior to her disappearance, but her two remaining siblings were living in Atlanta, Georgia. They leave Atlanta and head to Cedar Rapids to help look for Naomi also. So 2 days after Naomi was last seen, one of Colbert's brothers found Naomi's white 1978 Ford Fairmont. It was in the Kmart parking lot on 16th Avenue Southwest, just 2/10 of a mile from Reverend Wendell Beats's church. Reverend Wendell Beats is one of Colbert's brothers as well. So the Cedar Rapids police check the car and the trunk out at the scene, and then they let Colbert drive the car back to Naomi's house. The following day, April 15th, Reverend Paul Beats, another brother, borrows four walkie-talkies and leads a search party of 30 citizens to look for Naomi. The search started near the west side of the Kmart parking lot where Naomi's car had been found. This results in no Naomi, of course, but I don't believe that they found any evidence either. So far, everything here is going along just like one-off normal. But things just get a little weirder. By September of 1981, about 5 months after Naomi went missing, Colbert had moved into Naomi's house and was living there. The thing is, though, he wasn't paying the mortgage. He stayed there for quite a few months without paying the mortgage, but eventually he had to move out when the bank foreclosed on the house in January of 1982. So I don't know if any of what happens in the years after Naomi's disappearance has anything to do with Naomi being missing, but it's certainly odd. In the following years, the Beats brothers and their sons are all over the legal system as plaintiffs and defendants for a multitude of things. Now, they had these type of issues before Naomi went missing, but it seems to get worse after. I'm not going to run down the whole list, but I'll give you some key points I found interesting. If you want to know all about it, you can check out Naomi's profile on the Iowa Cold Case website. So I'll start right after Naomi's disappearance on April 25th of 1981. In an article in the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Colbert criticized the Cedar Rapids police for not dusting for fingerprints on Naomi's car when they found it. When it was addressed as to why he didn't express his concerns when they found the car and before he drove it away, he gives no explanation. In the same interview for this article, Colbert says he suspects foul play in Naomi's disappearance. Naomi's brothers, though, don't really have as much of an issue with law enforcement's efforts in her case, and at the time, they were trying to be positive about the situation. So apparently, Colbert ended up meeting someone and marrying her after Naomi's disappearance because apparently on September 25th of 1982, Colbert and his wife Sandra welcomed a son. Now, remember the Reverend Paul who apparently led the search the day after the car was found? Well, apparently sometime after Naomi's disappearance, he started preaching at a church on Old Marion Road Northeast on August 17th of 1987. He left the new church for 2 weeks for a theological conference in South Korea. Now, I'm sure you're asking why I'm even mentioning this. Well, it's because the theological conference was hosted by the Unification Church, also known as the Moonies, led by Reverend Sung Young Moon. If you don't know who the Moonies are, I'll make it really simple for you. They are essentially a cult. If you don't know about it, it's really crazy and it's really interesting. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think the podcast My Favorite Murder covers the Moonies in one of their episodes. I don't remember which episode, but if you like cult controversies, go look up the Moonies. It's crazy. But anyway, back to Naomi. So by October of 1987, Reverend Paul Beats and Reverend Wendell Beats are preaching at the same church. Okay, here's where it gets real bad. I'm just going to tell you straight from the cold case site. In 1992, allegations surfaced that the Reverend Wendell Beats, now leading the New Sound Doctrine Church, had sexually abused a teen parishioner for years. The accusation brings forth similar allegations, and in early August of 1992, Wendell Beats admits in front of 50 members of his 150 parishioners to sexual improprieties and misdeeds. Wendell Beats resigned from his new church, but before leaving town with his family, tells Luis Ellis, a minister in Beats' former church and the victim's mother, that nobody's going to stop me from preaching. Authorities issue a warrant for the 47-year-old Reverend Wendell Beats' arrest, and at 1:30 a.m. Wednesday, September 23rd of 1992, arrest him on charges of criminal sexual misconduct. By the time the Gazette goes to press for Thursday's paper, Beats had already posted the $26,000 bond and had been released. In a one-day trial, Wednesday, December 15th of 1993, Associate Linn County District Judge Michael Neuminster finds Wendell Beats guilty of assault with intent to commit sexual abuse against one of his young female parishioners. Okay, less than 2 years after this, Colbert and Wendell are reverends at the very same church where Wendell was the pastor before his arrest. On November 3rd of 1997, Richard Beats, the son of Reverend Paul Beats, allegedly commits suicide by drowning. Then, on November 5th of 2003, Marcus Beats, the son of Sandra and Colbert, dies by alleged self-inflicted gunshot wound. So, it just continues like this in the Beats family. They are repeatedly in the news for suffering financial difficulties and personal difficulties. all of the reverends switch churches a whole bunch, and one by one, they officiate funeral services for close family members and friends who have died mysteriously, or had very short illnesses, or have committed suicide. Now, before I finish up talking about the Beats brothers, I wanted to mention that they also have connections to a couple of other cold case homicides. Paula Jean Oberbrookling was 18 when she disappeared in July of 1970, so years before Naomi. They did eventually find her very decomposed body, but apparently the police chief at the time believed that Wendell and one of his sisters knew what happened to Paula. Paula's case is still unsolved. And then in June 21st of 1997, a 22-year-old woman named Tracy Ann Evenson was beaten and suffocated in her apartment in Cedar Rapids. The Reverend Wendell officiated her funeral service. Tracy's case is also unsolved. Now, moving on. In May of 2010, a Doe Network volunteer read about Naomi's case and saw similarities between Naomi and an unidentified homicide victim in Houston. Physically, the unidentified woman and Naomi matched. The volunteer submitted the potential match to proper authorities, but there was an issue. There were no fingerprints, dental records, or DNA on file for Naomi. Naomi also didn't have any children at the time of her disappearance, so there was no potential for DNA there. Luckily, though, they find a solution because they contact Naomi's two surviving brothers. And they are very happy to provide their DNA, realizing, of course, that having some DNA on file for Naomi opens up all types of new potential leads in her case. Unfortunately, though, Naomi's relative DNA did not match the Jane Doe's, so it shot Naomi's case back to square one, or back to where it was, which was in a very cold place. Naomi has yet to been located, and she has yet to be positively identified. Her case is considered cold, and police have very little evidence about what happened to her. So, if you can help solve the disappearance of Naomi Pollard Wilson, please contact the Cedar Rapids Police Department. Okay, so now we're really going to get into something. So, I'm going to tell you about a case that you may actually know, but it's going to lead to two more cases that you may not know. So, I have to start this run of connections with the disappearance of John David Gosch. He is case number 160 DMIA in the Doe Network, case number MP6131 in Namus, and his NCMEC number is 601763 because he was a juvenile. Now, you might know this case because John is well known for being one of the very first milk carton kids. There is much more interesting things involved in this case, and I'm sorry if you know this story, but you're going to have to listen to me tell it to you once again, because I need to tell you about him to tell you about some other people. So John is a Caucasian male with light brown hair and blue eyes. He was born on November 12th of 1969, and he was 12 at the time of his disappearance. He would be 50 now. At the time of his disappearance, he was 5'7" and 140 pounds. He was last seen wearing a white sweatshirt with Kim's Academy imprinted on the back, black sweatpants or cutoff jeans, and blue rubber thong sandals, or as I call them, flip-flops. John has freckles on his face. He has a gap, or had a gap, between his upper front teeth. He also has a horseshoe-shaped scar on his tongue and a birthmark on his left cheek. John also went by Johnny. So a lot of people know this case as the Johnny Gosch case. In 1982, 12-year-old Johnny had a paper route in West Des Moines. Johnny delivered papers early in the morning, and his dad, John, usually accompanied him on his route. On September 4th of 1982, Johnny asked his parents to be allowed to do his route on his own the next day. His parents said no. I assume this was so they could make sure he was safe. Well, on the morning of September 5th, Johnny wakes up at about 5:45 a.m. to get ready for his paper route and leaves the house. He doesn't wake up his dad, but instead he leaves the house with his miniature dachshund, Gretchen. Other paper carriers saw Johnny at the paper drop-off picking up his newspapers for delivery. At about 7 a.m., Johnny's parents, John and Noreen, started getting calls at the house. It was customers on Johnny's route wanting to know where their papers were. John and Noreen thought that maybe Johnny had overslept, so they head to his room, but Johnny isn't in bed. Gretchen, the little dachshund, had come back to the house, but Johnny wasn't anywhere around. John goes out to look for Johnny in the neighborhood, but he doesn't find Johnny. He instead finds Johnny's wagon about 2 blocks from their house full of undelivered newspapers. When they find this and know Johnny, John and Noreen call the West Des Moines Police Department and report Johnny missing. Now, according to Noreen's statements later, it took the police about 45 minutes to arrive at the house to take the report, but then they wouldn't officially list Johnny as missing until 72 hours later. Initially, law enforcement just thought Johnny was a runaway. The Goshes didn't think that this was the case, though. They were completely adamant that something had happened to their son. When police finally do start investigating, they find a couple of witnesses. A neighbor named Mike reported that he saw Johnny talking to a stocky man in a blue two-tone Ford Fairmont with Nebraska license plates. He didn't know what the two were talking about because he watched the interaction from his bedroom window. But apparently, it seemed like Johnny was giving the man directions. As Johnny was headed home, Mike then noticed another man following him. The second witness, a guy named John Rossi, saw a man in a blue car talking to Johnny, and he just thought something was strange about this. Now, John Rossi didn't look at the license. He did look at the license plate on the vehicle, but he couldn't remember the license plate number when the police spoke to him. Eventually, John Rossi agrees to hypnosis to try to recall the plate number, but this doesn't fully work. He was only able to recall some of the numbers and that the plate was from Warren County, Iowa. Eventually, the police do change their theory of Johnny's disappearance and finally agree that Johnny may have been kidnapped. Although they didn't know what the motive may be. A few months after Johnny was last seen, Noreen claims her son was spotted in Oklahoma when a boy yelled to a woman for help before being dragged off by two men. I only found this alleged sighting on one article, and I cannot say that this sighting has been confirmed. Over the years, the Goshes hired several private investigators to help locate their son. And they did really help. Unfortunately, not to any kind of resolve, though. In 1984, Johnny's picture was featured alongside the photo of Juanita Rafael Estevez on milk cartons. Johnny and Juanita were only the second and third abducted children to be featured on milk cartons. Things work out for Juanita, though, because she ended up escaping from her abductors in 1986. Okay, so some really good things and some really weird and really bad things come out of Johnny's disappearance. Johnny's case got national interest because Noreen really became increasingly vocal about the inadequacies of law enforcement's investigation of missing children cases. In 1982, the year Johnny disappeared, she established the Johnny Gosch Foundation. The foundation afforded Noreen the opportunity to visit schools and speak at seminars about the modus operandi of sexual predators. Noreen also lobbied for the Johnny Gosch Bill, which would mandate immediate police response to reports of missing children. The bill became law in 1984, and similar or identical laws were later passed in other states. In August of 1984, Noreen testified in Senate hearings on organized crime, speaking about organized pedophilia and its alleged role in her son's abduction. After this, Noreen started getting death threats. Noreen also testified before U.S. Department of Justice, which provided $10 million to establish the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which I mention every time I tell you about a juvenile case. Noreen was invited to the White House by President Reagan for this dedication ceremony. Now, in case you missed it, Noreen has a very strong belief that her son was abducted to be part of a child sex ring. So now I'm going to tell you about one thing that happened that supports this theory. In 1989, a 21-year-old man named Paul Bonacci told his attorney that he had been abducted into a sex ring. He claimed that Johnny was also in the sex ring with him when Johnny was a teenager, and he also claimed that he was forced to participate in Johnny's abduction. When the attorney met with Bonacci, he heard the story and believed that it was true. Noreen then met with him and she believed him as well. She said that Bonacci told her things that only someone who had talked to her son would know. He told Noreen about the birthmark Johnny has on his chest, about the scar on his tongue, and a burn scar on Johnny's lower leg. At this point in Johnny's case, these scars and marks had not been made public, but it is reported that they were widely known about. Bonacci also described to Noreen a stammer that Johnny had when he was upset. Police never viewed Bonacci as a credible witness, and thus they never interviewed him in regards to Johnny's case. This could be because it was discovered that Bonacci was actually in Omaha, Nebraska on the day Johnny disappeared. This isn't the end of Bonacci, though. This next part will come straight from the Wikipedia page. Bonacci went on to accuse Republican Party activist and businessman Lawrence E. King, who also served as director of the Franklin Credit Union in Omaha, Nebraska, of running an underage prostitution ring and victimizing him since an early age. In 1990, a county grand jury declined to charge King, finding the allegations to be a carefully crafted hoax. Paul Bonacci and Alicia Owens were indicted on state perjury charges. A federal grand jury also declined to indict anyone for child prostitution, but did return indictment against Owen for perjury and King for fraud related to the credit union. King was accused of looting $40 million from the bank and was sentenced to 15 years in prison. The bank was shut down in November of 1988 when it was raided by the FBI, the IRS, and the NCUA. King was eventually released from prison in April of 2001. Bonacci did go on to sue King civilly for compensatory damages and punitive damages. King did not respond to the lawsuit, thus a default judgment was awarded in the amount of $1 million. So I wanted to tell you that because it brings up the Franklin Credit Union, which is another thing in and of itself. Essentially, the Franklin Credit Union has long been believed to be a front for a child prostitution ring. Now, of course, it is all allegations and no charges have ever been brought forth from anything to do with the child prostitution and credit union. But if you really get into it and you kind of have to like conspiracy theories, there are some connections that would suggest that it actually was connected to a child prostitution ring. So Johnny's disappearance becomes too much for John and Noreen to handle together. And as we see so many times, they ended up divorcing. From what I saw in this case, I think that Noreen's obsession with Johnny's disappearance caused the marriage some additional stress. So they divorced sometime in 1993. In March of 1997, Noreen is living in an apartment on her own. It's about 2:30 a.m. when she wakes up to a knock at her door. She opens the door to see two men. Now, this is 15 years after Johnny's disappearance. But as soon as Noreen opens the door, she recognizes the face of her now 27-year-old son. The man opened up his shirt to show Noreen a familiar birthmark on his chest, but this didn't matter. Noreen knew who he was even before he did that. The other man, Noreen didn't know. Noreen would later say her son was wearing jeans and a shirt and a coat because it was cold outside. He had long shoulder-length hair and it was straight and dyed black. Noreen allows the two men into her apartment and she talks to Johnny for about an hour or an hour and a half. During the conversation, Noreen said Johnny continued to look over at the other man as if he was asking permission to speak. During the conversation, Noreen said her son told her that he had been abducted by members of a pedophile ring. He claimed he had escaped from the group sometime before, but he was in hiding to avoid prosecution. Oh, I'm sorry, repercussions from his captors, and that he would probably never visit her again. He didn't tell her where he was staying or where he was going. The pair eventually leave, and they were never seen again. Immediately following this encounter, Noreen goes to the FBI. She gets a sketch artist to produce a portrait of her adult son as she saw him that night. Now, here's the thing. No one else saw this encounter. There was also no evidence to suggest that it actually happened. So while police are not saying it absolutely didn't happen, they're saying they don't have any evidence to confirm it. John, Johnny's dad, has publicly stated that he is not sure whether or not this visit actually occurred. In 2000, Noreen self-published a book she wrote called Johnny, or Why Johnny Can't Come Home. The book is basically her understanding of what her son went through based on the original research and various private investigators, as well as her son's alleged visit. Then on September 1st of 2006, Noreen reported that she found photographs left on her front door. The color photo showed three boys bound and gagged. Noreen claimed that a black and white photo appeared to show a 12-year-old Johnny gagged with his hands and feet tied and with an apparent human brand on his shoulder. There was also a third photo that showed a man who may or may not have been dead, with something tied around his neck. Noreen alleged that this man in the third photo was one of the perpetrators who had molested her son. Noreen would later say that the first two photos were originally on a website featuring child pornography. Then on September 13th of 2006, 12 days after Noreen found the photos, an anonymous letter was mailed to the Des Moines police. It reads as follows: Gentlemen, someone has played a reprehensible joke on a grieving mother. The photo in question is not one of her son, but of three boys in Tampa, Florida, about 1979-80, challenging each other to an escape contest. There was an investigation concerning that picture made by the Hillsborough County, Florida Sheriff's Office. No charges were filed, and no wrongdoing was established. The lead detective on the case was named Zalva. This allegation should be easy enough to check out. And they do actually check this out. Nelson Zalva, who worked for the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office in the 70s, said the details of the letter were true and adds that he also investigated the black and white in 1978 or 1979 before Johnny disappeared. He said, quote, I interviewed the kids and they said there was no coercion or touching. I could never prove a crime. When asked for proof that this was indeed the same photo from the investigation from almost 3 decades earlier, Zalva couldn't provide any. According to the 2014 documentary film Who Took Johnny, only three boys in the picture were identified by law enforcement, but not the one thought to be Johnny. Noreen still believes the picture is of her son. So Johnny is still missing, and the investigating agency in his case is West Des Moines Police Department. So if you have any information about him, call that agency and report it. I do have to tell you about something else that came up during Johnny's case. So Noreen claims that she was personally informed of another potential abduction that hadn't yet occurred in early 1984. She was told about this potential abduction by a private investigator who was looking for Johnny. She was told the kidnapping would take place the second weekend in August of 1984, and the abducted would be a paper boy from the south side of Des Moines. Now, however this information was obtained, or if it was just premonition, it turned out to be true. Because on August 12th of 1984, almost 2 years after Johnny went missing, Eugene Wayne Martin disappeared from Des Moines, Iowa. So now I'm going to tell you about his case. Eugene Wayne Martin is case number 8DMIA in the DOE Network, case number MP6348 in NamUs, and his NCMEC number is 601815. Gene, as he was known, is a Caucasian male with brown hair and brown eyes. He was born on August 17th of 1970. He was 13, almost 14 at the time of his disappearance, and he would be 49 now. At the time, he was 5 foot and 110 pounds. He was last seen wearing a gray and white striped midriff t-shirt with red sleeves, blue jeans, and blue track sneakers with white diagonal stripes. Gene has a scar on his right knee, and one of his wrists had a healed fracture. Now, I'll tell you straight up, this case is going to sound very similar to Johnny's case, but police have never confirmed a connection between the two boys' disappearances. So, like Johnny, 13-year-old Gene had a paper route that he would deliver in the early morning. Usually, Gene would be accompanied on his route by his older stepbrother. On the morning of August 12, 1984, Gene went out to deliver the paper alone. He left the house around 5 to start his route delivering the Des Moines Register. Some time passes, about an hour or so, and then people start calling the newspaper office wanting to know where their paper is. So the route manager decides to go find Gene and see why the papers weren't being delivered. So he or she checks along Gene's route and they don't find Gene, but they do find Gene's bag on the ground outside of Des Moines with 10 folded papers still inside. This was at about 6:10, 6:15 a.m. So from what I understand at that point, the manager calls Gene's parents and tells them that he found Gene's bag, but Gene wasn't around. And I think he or she decided to wait for a few minutes to see if Gene would come back for the bag. So he hangs up with Gene's parents and waits. About 15 minutes later, the manager calls back and says Gene hadn't returned. At this point, Gene's dad calls the police, and by 8:40 a.m., the search for Gene was on. Now, I wouldn't be telling you the story if they had actually found him, so let me tell you what they do find out. When they begin investigating Gene's disappearance, they find some witnesses who say they saw Gene that morning. Witnesses said they saw Gene talking to a clean-cut white male in his 30s between 5 and 5:45 a.m. Some witnesses said Gene and this man appeared to be engaged in a friendly father-son sort of conversation. Other witnesses said they saw Gene folding the newspapers while talking to the man between 5:45 and 6:05 a.m. Based on the witnesses' statements, police released a description of the man for a nationwide bulletin. He was described as between 30 and 40 years old, 5'9", clean-shaven, and with a medium build. The FBI gets involved in Gene's case, of course, and they work up a profile on this person. They say, generally, the person is an introvert, a loner who may or may not be extra guilt-ridden on what he does, but he will not turn himself in. Even with all of this in the public, it doesn't help. Beyond the description of that person of interest, there ends up being a $94,000 reward for information about Johnny or Gene. $25,000 of that was offered by the Des Moines Register itself. Even the money, though, didn't bring any substantial leads. Now, there is nothing super crazy that goes on after Gene's disappearance like there was in Johnny's case, but Gene's disappearance really affects some people in a way that couldn't be reversed. After Gene's disappearance, his dad, Don Martin, took the whole matter pretty hard. He became withdrawn and spent all of his time trying to find out what happened to his son. And Gene was actually the youngest child. So Don kind of went into his own world and wouldn't really talk to anyone, but he continued to read everything there was about Gene's case, and he would cut out articles and write-ups about his son's disappearance. Donald Martin died on December 27th of 2010 due to complications from Alzheimer's disease and colon cancer. He served in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War from 1963 to 1966. During his service, he earned the Good Conduct Medal, Expert M1 Rifle Medal, Sharpshooter M14 Medal, as well as the Vietnam Service Medal. He was only 65 when he passed away, having lived through war and his son's disappearance, but it is long thought that Gene's disappearance is what pushed him closer to the grave. He died not having any answers to the biggest question in his life. Now, I didn't find much about Gene's mother, Janice, but apparently she died sometime before Don died, and all I could find is that she died from diabetes. Now, I have to tell you about the detective, James Rowley. Rowley, I'm sorry. Rowley handled Gene's case from the beginning. Now he says the similarities between Gene's case and Johnny's case, and he saw the similarities, I'm sorry, between the two cases. He had some issues with believing that they were connected, though. Rowley really did his very best with Gene's case. He heard all the theories and conspiracies, but he couldn't connect them in a way that would make sense. He traveled to Mexico and Canada to follow up on tips. He chased down what he estimated was between 2,000 and 3,000 leads during the investigation, but not one trip or lead led to any credible evidence. During the course of the investigation, Don Martin and Detective Rowley actually became really good friends. The two met every week for years on Friday evenings to talk about any new leads. Gene's case bothers Rowley more than any other case he has ever worked on, which is a very extensive list with about an 80% solve rate. What bothered him the most is that there was nothing to go on. In Rowley's home garage, he hung a poster of Gene to remind him every day. And even though Rowley retired in 2001, he said that poster will stay in his garage until Gene is found or his case is solved. This is the one case that still haunts him. So Eugene Wade Martin is still missing. And if you have any information that can help solve this case, please contact the Des Moines Police Department. So the next case may be connected, but there is far less information about this case, and we'll talk about why that may be. Let's get into this case, which is case number 34DMIA in the Doe Network, case number MP5790 in Namus, and his NCMEC number is 1053047. This is the disappearance of Mark James Warren Allen II. Mark is a Caucasian male. He was born, he has brown hair and blue eyes. He was born on May 13th of 1972 and was 13 at the time of his disappearance. He would be 48 now. At the time of his disappearance, he was between 4'11" and 5' and weighed about 90 pounds. He was last seen wearing a light blue t-shirt, blue denim shorts, white socks, and gray sneakers with Velcro fastenings. Mark has a small scar on the top of his head. So Mark was raised in Connecticut by his grandmother from about 7 months old until he was about 4.5. At that age, he moved to Des Moines until he was about 10, and then he moved to his father's house in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But by January of 1985, when he was 12, he was back in Des Moines with his mother and his two siblings. Now, why did he move around so much at a young age? I'm not sure, but Mark was often described more than once as being intelligent and a good student, but his mom said he had no common sense and he had behavior problems. So maybe the moving around was because adults were having problems with getting Mark under control. On March 29th of 1986, Mark was at home with his mom and two siblings at their home on Emma Avenue in Des Moines, I'm sorry. Now, it doesn't say, but I imagine it's early in the afternoon when Mark told his mom that he was going to walk to a friend's house down the street and they might go see a movie. His siblings were about to eat pizza, and as Mark walked out the back door, he said, "Save me some pizza, Mom. I'll be hungry when I get home." Mark never made it to that friend's house. The next morning, Mark's mom realized that Mark hadn't made it home the night before. It was Easter Sunday, so his mom, Nancy, tried to remain calm and called Mark's grandmother to see if he was there. Nancy figured that Mark knew his grandmother would have an Easter basket for him, so maybe he went there to get it. But when she called his grandmother, she said he wasn't there. Nancy still tries to remain calm and started calling Mark's friends. When she speaks to all of the friends, and they all say they hadn't seen Mark, Nancy decides it's time to worry. So she calls the police, but guess what? They wouldn't do anything and they wouldn't take the missing persons report until after 48 hours. This is so unlike Johnny and Jean's case, or it's unlike Jean's case, because in Jean's disappearance, they jumped right on it. But in Johnny's case, even though the police wouldn't take the missing persons report, his parents were out there searching for him. But anyway, let's get back to it. So when the police do look into Mark's disappearance, they of course initially draw the conclusion that Mark had run away. Eventually, that does change in the theory, and they theorize that Mark was abducted. So why didn't Mark's case get attention like Johnny and Jean's? Well, some people theorize some people theorize that the police didn't want to make Mark's disappearance a big deal because they didn't want the Des Moines community to think that they had a big problem where their kids weren't safe walking on the streets, even though apparently they weren't. In Mark's case, they really try to steer clear of a connection to Johnny and Jean, too. Now, there are some differences, but I'll say there are some similarities. Mark wasn't a paper boy, and his disappearance did not occur in the early morning hours. There were no witness statements about Mark talking to a Caucasian male either. Here's what I found similar, though. Mark was most likely abducted while he was walking on the sidewalk in Des Moines, the same city where both Johnny and Jean had disappeared from. Mark fits the same physical type, and he is also around the same age. The thing that I find particularly connecting is that Jean disappeared 23 months after Johnny disappeared. Mark disappeared 20 months after Jean. All of these disappearances seem to occur just short of 2 years apart. Now, granted, Johnny and Jean went missing during the summer and Mark disappeared during the spring, but I don't think you can deny that the timeline is suspicious. Now, there is no evidence that connects any of these boys' cases to each other, and honestly, they might not be connected at all. And it's just a weird string of coincidences. Mark's case is the one of the three with the least information, and I think that really honestly sucks. It's almost as if Des Moines police didn't want to admit that they had a third young boy who had been abducted. But if you can help with Mark James Warren Allen II's case, you can contact the Des Moines Police Department and provide them with any information that you may have, because there doesn't appear to be a whole lot on his case anyway. Okay, I have one last case for you this week. This is case number 53DFIA in the Doe Network and case number MP17088 in Namus. This is the disappearance of Denise or Dean Fraley. Denise is a Caucasian female with brown hair and hazel eyes. She was born on April 4th of 1952. She was 30 at the time of her disappearance, and she would be 68 now. She stood at 5'4" and 115 pounds. Denise's maiden name is Stark. So when I found Denise's case on the Iowa Cold Case site, they had an article that told Denise's story. They did it so beautifully that I'm not going to change much about it. So my telling of this story is going to come from an article in the Cedar Rapids Gazette on March 19th of 1992. It was written by Jeff Burnham, and it is titled "Murdered, Missing, Unsolved: Police Suspect Three Killed But Lack of Body." Now, this article is part of a series in which Jeff wrote about three missing Iowa women. I'm not covering the other two women, but I'll tell you their names if you want to read about them yourself. Besides Denise, he covers Jane Wakefield and Lynn Schuler. I did read over these stories and I just settled on covering Denise's solely, but the other two cases are quite interesting, and I always encourage you to read about as many missing people as you can. Denise was born and raised in Northwest Missouri. Denise Stark was a cheerleader in high school and graduated as the valedictorian of her class. In the early 1970s, Denise moved to Cedar Rapids to live with her grandmother. This is when Denise meets Dave Fraley, and they begin to date. They eventually marry in 1975. 4 years later, Dave and Denise welcome a daughter, Haley Jo. When Haley Jo was born, Denise stayed home to raise her while Dave worked as a pest control technician. But both Dave and Denise played in bands. Denise would often sing, and Dave played the piano. Later court records would say that Dave and Denise used illegal drugs. It was also found that Dave was a drug courier, and it is suspected, based on Dave's statements later, that Denise was also a courier. Apparently, Dave and Denise's marriage was not all sunshines and rainbows, though. According to a 21-page ruling issued by a judge during a later custody battle after Denise's disappearance, the marriage was scattered with violent episodes. There were two documented episodes where Denise went to the hospital after Dave had tied her up and beat her. That judge's ruling also says police were called to the Fraley home in June of 1981 after Dave threatened Denise with a gun while he was drunk. Dave later said that all of the violent episodes were simply him defending himself from his aggressive wife, but the judge wrote that the evidence indicated that Dave was lying. The marriage eventually got so bad that Dave filed for divorce in May of 1982. Denise's response to the pending divorce was asking for custody of their daughter, who was 2.5 at that time. Denise also obtained a restraining order for herself and her daughter, which prevented Dave from having any contact with them. Denise obtained the restraining order on the basis of the recent violence, by Dave, including threats to kill her. It seemed like the couple was trying to reconcile, though, because they spent Labor Day weekend together in 1982 in Missouri with Denise's sister. After this weekend together, Denise and Dave's band had plans to play at a private party in Cedar Rapids on the evening of September 11th, 1982. Dave had arranged the gig for the band. Dave would claim that Denise disappeared on this night. The thing was, though, that Dave's account of where he last saw Denise changed more than once. It was really never clear if he last saw her at the party or back at home. When this issue came up in the later divorce proceedings, Dave would say he had issues remembering because he had been drinking and smoking marijuana. It was over a month before Denise's family in Missouri had any idea that Denise was gone. In mid-October, Denise's mother called the house wanting to talk to Denise. Dave answered the phone, and when she asked for Denise, Dave hung up. She then called the Cedar Rapids police and sent them to Denise's house, basically for a welfare check. What happened when police got to the house is unclear, What is clear is that Denise's mom officially reported Denise missing on October 18th of 1982. Within a week of reporting Denise missing, Dave called her family and explained that Denise had tried to run off with several thousand dollars in drug money that was not hers, and he feared that the mafia was looking for her. Dave tells the family that the mafia wouldn't take kindly to Denise's relatives traveling to Cedar Rapids looking for answers. And so, for 6 months, Denise's family believed Dave and stayed away from Cedar Rapids. At the same time, in Cedar Rapids, the investigation into Denise's disappearance stalls. Eventually, Denise's sister decided that she didn't believe Dave and she didn't care if the mafia was involved. In March of 1983, Denise's sister and mother made the first of many trips to Cedar Rapids. Once they started making these trips, they get things going, really. They convinced Cedar Rapids police to reopen the investigation. They also hired their own private investigator, and they hired an attorney and entered the divorce proceedings to obtain custody of Haley Joe. For about 6 months, while the custody proceeding was pending, Denise's family got temporary custody of Haley Joe. During that period of time, the family would later say in court affidavits that Haley Joe told them she had seen her mom tied to rocks and thrown into a river. Child development experts later interviewed Haley Joe and said her statements would be take should be taken seriously, but they could not conclude whether she was speaking of something she had actually seen or if the story came from watching the movie Poltergeist. Unfortunately, the investigation into Denise's disappearance stalled again, but the investigator at the time said he believed that there was a 50-50 chance that Denise was murdered. He even named her likely killer. Through the various investigations, Denise's family started learning that Dave had given several conflicting explanations about what happened to Denise. While some were told that Denise had been harmed by drug-dealing thugs, others were told by Dave that Denise had simply run off to further her singing career. The custody battle over Haley Joe continued for several months, including a included was a deposition by Dave that said Denise called him 2 days after the party and said that she had been ripped off in a drug deal and told him to take care of Haley Joe. Dave said he hadn't seen or heard from Denise since then. He explained those other accounts by saying he was just speculating to some people about what might have happened to Denise. In the same testimony, Dave said he had been kidnapped and forced to take a lie detector test by individuals with the mafia who wanted to find Denise and the money she had allegedly taken. But he also indicated he wasn't particularly interested in helping the police find those thugs or in helping finding Denise. Denise and Dave's divorce was granted in January of 1984. The custody battle ended about the same time. The judgment for custody was that Dave was awarded full custody of Haley Joe. So while the investigation into Denise's disappearance has stalled and cold, a lot of people still want to know what happened to her. I'm sure her own daughter, especially. So if you know anything about the disappearance of Denise or Dean Fraley, you can contact the Cedar Rapids Police Department. Well, that's it for this episode. I don't have a scene again for you this week. I'm sorry. I'm working on getting more bonus episodes recorded for you, which will include a scene again or two in those bonus episodes. So I'll have those out at some point. I hope that you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, I hope that you will find it in your heart to tell everyone about it. If you haven't done so already, please go like, follow, favorite, rate, and/or review this podcast on whatever platform you listen on, if any of those are an option. Stitcher and Apple Podcast listeners, do me the favor and give this podcast those 5 stars. I know it requires you to leave a review, but say whatever you want there. The stars are what matters the most. You can simply say that you are doing what you were asked to in the review. Again, if you haven't already done so, you can find the podcast's Facebook page at facebook.com/NTBSAPodcast. If you like and follow the page, you can see that when new episodes are up and available, and you can also see the pictures of the people I cover in each episode. From there, you can also message me with case suggestions. But if you don't have Facebook, you still have a case suggestion, you can email me at nevertobeseenagainpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much for all of your support every week. Thank you, everyone who has left a rating and or a review. I really do appreciate every single one of my listeners. Thank you guys so much for tuning in every week, and I hope that you decide to tune in for another week when I'll be back to tell you more about those never to be seen again.